attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chin wag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Alex Smith. Attempting to extract the bullshit from business strategy is a little like attempting to put tiny Reebok pump trainers onto every frog in the world. And yet, miraculously, Alex Smith has made a considerable and admirable dent in that remarkably daunting task, not least through his best-selling book, No Bullshit Strategy. At the heart of his refreshingly readable philosophy is his mission to show businesses of all shapes and sizes the simple, reliable techniques that prevent them from making the anti-strategic decisions they habitually and obliviously make. An antidote to lofty ivory tower academia in the field, Alex's teachings, which he also generously dishes out on LinkedIn for nout, are about making strategy an easy thing for founders to get right more of the time. Alex says most strategy is, let's face it, bullshit. A bunch of fancy words which mean nothing at all. At best, harmless and easy to ignore. At worst, confusing and destructive. I want to fix that. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. And yeah, well, you do a better intro than I do of myself. I'll have to ask for the transcript of that.
Snip that. Amazing. Right, we've got seven quick fires. So, Mac or PC?
Oh, Mac.
Words or pictures?
Oh, words, I suppose.
Art or science?
Art.
City or United?
United, tragically.
Nickelback or Starbucks?
Oh, someone's got to stand up for Nickelback, so it'll be me.
Lovely. So Nickelback. Two more. Be better or be different?
Oh, be different, as we know.
Tap in, easy. Number seven, then, hyper-focus or mass market?
Mass market, all the way.
Love it, amazing. Well, you should be warmed up now, Alex. So to start the show, we ask every guest about their path to where they are now and find, as we said pre-recording, that it's rarely linear. Importantly for me, there's huge value in people understanding that talented people don't just step out of a shiny college or university straight into a shiny career. So can you start by telling the audience about your first ever jobs and what was your first proper job?
Sure. I mean, well, obviously I had my smattering of sort of non-jobs like weeding sugar beet fields and stuff like that. That's the one that really sticks in the mind. But you know, in the classic sort of post-uni grad scheme universe, obviously that's when the kind of the more obvious part of the story begins. And I was writing about this just the other day, and about how I think that we all begin, and most of us actually continue, doing things that don't necessarily suit us or don't necessarily reflect us, but they're the thing we're basically copying. We copy the examples that we have in our life, or we copy the things which we think for whatever reason are quite cool or aspirational without giving any thought to whether that's something which is actually a good fit for you. And so I was a very extreme example of this. My first job was at EY, and bearing in mind both of my parents were accountants at KPMG, and my sister actually had a stint at PwC. So we almost had we could be the big four family. We weren't far off that dream, but I got fired. So that pretty quickly blew that one out. Then I went to L'Oreal on their grad scheme, and I also got fired from that. So I had two like colossal failures. And then after being unemployed for about 6 months or something like that, I mean, I'd always wanted really, after the whole sort of finance, EY, accountancy thing, whatever, bit the dust, I always wanted to be in advertising as I perceived it. And again, the only reason I wanted to do this is because of the movie What Women Want. I don't know if you remember that movie and Mel Gibson, and
yes,
and the way that it, like, that, yeah, the movie about, you know, reading the minds of women and all that, I could sort of take or leave. What I was into was the portrayal of the office culture of advertising. There was a point in time, wasn't there, where every single rom-com was basically set in an ad agency, because at that time that was the aspirational job. So as I was of that age, that was kind of like the job that you would want to do. And now nobody wants to do it. But, you know, there was a time when that was what anyone would want to do. But the closest that I could get to that was going and being a junior account manager in an experiential marketing agency, which, you know, I would tell people, you know, at a dinner party was an advertising agency, but we all know that it's a little bit different. That was one where finally I didn't get fired from. And so probably then I started to, you know, climb the ladder, so to speak.
There's a lot to unpack there. Can I ask you to elaborate on either or both firings, or do I need to sign an NDA first?
I wish that it was for a cool reason, but it wasn't. It was just really just, you know, those type of big organizations, they're well-oiled machines. They're very good at kind of their immune systems sort of rejecting the, you know, the antibodies rejecting the virus kind of thing.
Nice. What a flattering word to describe yourself as, Alex.
I was just processed out. I mean, in hindsight, I could see totally why it was. I mean, you have, like, fundamentally, I was very, very annoying in both scenarios and quite disruptive. And when I say disruptive, I don't want to say that, like, not in a, oh, I'm such a rebel, aren't I disruptive, Steve Jobs kind of way. I don't mean it in a kind of complimentary sense. I just mean, like, not just getting along with recognizing that if you were a very junior employee in a big organization like that, your job is to do what you're given and keep the machine running smoothly, and not to constantly sort of question, you know, why are we doing it this way? Or, like, to sort of notice flaws, let's say, or perceived flaws in their system. It doesn't even matter whether you're right or wrong. Maybe I was right, maybe I was wrong. Let's just say, for sake of argument, I was wrong about everything. I just didn't recognize what was required of me in that environment. And so they were very, so I was just a sort of high friction employee. So they were very right to eject me. And when I went to the agency, the only reason why that worked is simply because, you know, a 1,000-person company is a well-oiled machine. It's got good systems, and they want people to come in and to be quality operators within that system. And that wasn't me, because I wasn't, you know, I was a squeaky wheel, so to speak. But when you go to a 30-person, 40-person company, that company is still kind of the Wild West. It's still growing. There isn't really a well-established way of doing things. And so being a bit sort of annoying and questioning can be an asset in that environment, whilst it's the opposite of being an asset in, like, a L'Oreal or an EY. And so this was probably my first lesson in just recognizing that you have different, people have different sensibilities, and and some people are going to have a small company sensibility, and some people are going to have a big company sensibility. And I very, very strongly, although I was completely unconscious of it, had a small company sensibility. And so I was always going to fail until I got myself into a sort of sub 50 person company, I think.
Yeah, that, to be honest, that makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure if I've shared this on the pod before, but my first boss in Adland described me as annoyingly curious and curiously annoying, just because of the questions I would ask, because I just didn't know and I wanted to understand. And actually, that was around about a 40, 50 strong agency. So we're talking, you know, the smaller scale. God knows how I would have fared in an EY type establishment. If we rewind it slightly, you went to university. Was that with the intent to go into Adland, or had you not seen what women want yet?
Here's how it went, actually. No, it was in, I did a 4-year degree, and my EY thing was the summer internship, whereby, of course, it's just an internship, but it's considered to be a formality that then you will go from the internship to the grad scheme. That was where they spat me out by being, I think I was maybe the only person on the internship who wasn't invited to go on the grad scheme. So that was in the summer of my third year. Then I had my fourth year, and I think that's when I thought, all right, well, now we'll look at advertising. But, you know, I applied to all of the all the big agencies, all the grad schemes, AMV, all these things. Like, you know, I didn't get so much as an interview. It was, I mean, even now, I don't think I would get so much of as an interview. I perceived it to be an impossible task to get a look in at those sort of places. And I don't know what I was doing wrong, but that was, I can remember very clearly being feeling dejected that it was impossible to enter that industry. And so L'Oreal was actually, it was a backup.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't able to get any jobs in advertising.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Makes complete sense. It's funny, I think this is our 159th episode, and what I have found in my ape brain that is desperate to find patterns in people I speak to is that there's a lot of serendipity and luck at play as to how people end up in this kind of industry. And I say kind of because obviously we talk about marketing and advertising and overlapping careers. The ones that do follow a more kind of intentional path, we can probably put it as, tend to go into account management, which I think other people have described as a sort of gateway drug into advertising, and then sidestep into the kind of planning and strategy world. Obviously, your time at L'Oreal, I'm sure, was significant because they, you know, they certainly know how to train marketers. Having then moved to an experiential agency, which is probably at the tail end when you're thinking about planning and execution of a marketing strategy, how and why did you start to kind of move upstream and become more interested in what had happened prior to you might be engaged as an agency? Because that's all stuff can happen over time. Like what I find is that you can, and in the intro we talked about, and in fact, the way your book is described, which we'll come on to a bit later, a bunch of fancy words which mean nothing at all. I imagine there's no shortage of fancy words that mean nothing at all at you know, everywhere from EY, I suppose, which I say with respect, to any agency. So is it more a case of just trying to seek clarity and meaning within all the nonsense?
Not consciously. The way that it unfolded was this. So all agencies of any stripe, whether it's, you know, BBH or an experiential agency or a shopper agency, whatever, they all basically implicitly have one job. And that job is to put lipstick on the pig or polish the turd. You know, brands will come to them, and of course they will never put it this way, but they're all asking the same question, which is, how can you take our, in some sense, inferior, inadequate offering and spin it, polish it in such a way that people actually want it?
Yeah.
Or that they want it more than they would want it without your assistance. And the role of both strategy and, moreover, creativity in agency world is to do that polishing and to make things look better than they really are. And that's the fun of it from the point of view of an agency. And actually, the worse a client is in some senses, the more fun it is to work on that client. When I say the worse, I mean the worse their offer is, the worse their product is, because the more contortions you have to do to make it seem cool. But then what I noticed after a while is that, yeah, there was this sort of continuum of clients where sometimes, one time out of 10, you would get a client where the thing that they were selling and their kind of offer in the market was so coherent, so sort of desirable and so inherently interesting that the agency didn't have to do any creative thinking. And actually, any creative thinking that you did beyond just a bit of sort of presentational flair actually ran the risk of damaging the message of that company rather than enhancing it. And the agency basically gets relegated to the position of being a sort of messenger boy. And this never happened, but just to give you a very sort of simplistic example, like if you were in an agency and, I don't know, Red Bull came to you, Red Bull aren't going to come to you with that sort of meek cap in hand, show us how to be cool, Mr. Agency. They know exactly what they're doing, and the power dynamic that they would have with an agency, I assume, I never worked with Red Bull, but I'm just illustrating the point. The power dynamics they would have with an agency would be very different. And they would just be like, they know what they want to do, they know what they need to do, and they just tell the agency to execute. You know, there's obviously Apple for a long time, even now, I don't know. They had their own, I can't remember what it's called, but they had basically their own creative agency. And now, of course, they do all their creative in-house, I think, as well. So, like, you know, a powerful brand like Apple sort of opted out of the agency world a long time ago. So because they sort of know what they're doing. And so I started to think, wow, you know, it'd be really interesting to take those, rather than just sort of like constantly putting lipstick on the pig, I'd quite like to work on the pig itself. Wouldn't it be quite cool to make those 9 out of 10 clients more like those 1 out of 10 clients for whom sort of the creative marketing is a luxury rather than a crutch? And that's where I started to develop my interest in what we might now call business strategy. But the thing is because I had no knowledge whatsoever about the field of business strategy, capital B, capital S, Michael Porter, Blue Ocean strategy, MBA, blah, blah, blah. Like I had no vocabulary for this. I had no knowledge of this. I genuinely thought at the time, so in a bubble and so sheltered was I, that I was actually generating a whole new body of theory about how businesses might work. And my original way of interpreting it, which I had to move away from for various commercial reasons, but my first kind of gambit in this space was this idea of making a business so interesting that it doesn't have to do advertising. And my sort of tagline was make interesting companies, not interesting advertising. And of course, there are certain brands like Lush, Tesla, I think Zara might be one, Monster, who sort of make a point of not doing any sort of paid advertising. I don't know if that's still true, but that was true at a time. So I was very fascinated by these sort of brands. And my whole thesis was kind of like, nobody should do any advertising, at least as a thought experiment. And if that was the case, how could we create a situation? How could we make a brand be a brand that doesn't do advertising? So that was where I started to think in this direction, little knowing that I was just encroaching onto a territory which is actually incredibly well-established and rich. And basically, people have already figured all of this stuff out. But I was just kind of like trying to make it up from whole cloth.
Yeah, totally. It's funny. I suppose it's not a rare conversation that I have with people both sides of the kind of client brand slash agency side marketers, how much of the kind of rhetoric that comes out of our industry from all sorts, not just the kind of main media mouths, is rediscovering the old or the existing things that we already knew. And I mean, one easy example to go to is, you know, something that Richard Shotton, Rory Sutherland and Mark Earls have popularized in recent years, like the pratfall effect of admitting your flaws, admitting your weaknesses, oh, yeah. And all of those kinds of psychological nudges. But actually, if you rewind another, I don't know, 40, 50 years to the work of, say, I don't know, Birnbach, they were using the pratfall effect already before it had been coined as an effect or as a heuristic. And actually, I'm torn between thinking there it's frustrating people haven't studied the past so they know that there's work there in this field, or, and I think this is where I lean into, that actually it's really beneficial for people to go on this whole discovery and find something, because it's that journey of discovery that makes things stick and make things meaningful for that individual or company.
I'd be inclined to agree with you on that. I mean, just because you read a book doesn't mean that you actually know the stuff that's in the book. You know, it only goes in one ear and out the other.
Totally, yeah. Well, funny enough, one of the quick fires I was going to ask you was theory or practice for that very point. And obviously, I think one of the things, the only thing we need to avoid, ironically, given the way I've just set up that sentence, is kind of absolutism in the industry, that there is kind of one path. And something that I do really admire about the work that you share openly on LinkedIn is that there are so many iterations and techniques and styles that come through when you talk about strategy. So do you have a go-to for what you describe strategy as?
I do. So obviously, one of the ways that people come unstuck badly with this field is that there is clearly a definition of strategy writ large, you know, the dictionary definition, which applies to a strategy for anything, you know, getting a six pack, winning a war and such, which is, and that definition is always something along the lines of, oh, it's a sort of plan to achieve a goal or variations on that theme. So of course this is true, but the reason I think that people get so mixed up is because that definition, it doesn't provide any clear guidance about what a strategy should look like or what is the thing that they are meant to be creating. And so I think it's actually much better if we create these sort of sub definitions of strategy. So business strategy is clearly a subset of strategy writ large. And obviously I write about, I mean, I do tip over more sometimes into sort of more philosophical strategy, but basically I'm writing about business strategy. And so we can actually tighten the definition. We can bring it way, way, way down into a much more manageable, much more practical form if we just say, okay, well, what is the strategy of a business? And to answer that is super simple, because all you really need to do is you need to understand what is a business, like sort of existentially, what is a business? What is every business on the planet? And then what makes that thing work? And that thing is going to be the same for everyone. And if you know what that thing is, then you basically know what your job is when you're running a business. It's just to do this thing. So obviously what a business is, whether you're a 12-year-old girl selling friendship bracelets out of her bedroom or chief executive of Halliburton, all a business is it's a system designed to generate value, which you then exchange for another form of value, money. And so how big a business grows is simply a direct reflection of how much value it manages to generate. Because if you generate lots and lots of value, then you'll be able to exchange that for lots and lots of money. So we can recognize that, like, the first and, to be honest, only job of any business and any business owner is to sit there thinking, right, how can I generate new value that doesn't currently exist out there in the market? And that word new is key. And this is, I think, where 9 out of 10 businesses come unstuck, that they don't appreciate that if the value that your business is producing, whatever it might be, is something that people can already get from elsewhere, then it may as well not exist. You aren't actually truly giving value. And that's why you struggle to make money, because you're launching yourself into a competitive context with all the other people out there who are generating that for that same form of value. I mean, very simple example, if we're in the agency world is far worse than most industries on this thing. But like every single agency out there who thinks, for example, that creativity is a meaningful metric to sell and deliver to the market, and that the market is going to reward you for creativity, like it should be self-evident that that is not a legitimate form of value to put out there in the market, because that's a little bit like trying to sell a car on the basis that it's got 4 wheels. That's just a foundational generic of the category that you're existing in. It's always that thing that you deliver on top of the generic, which is going to be the thing that gives you leverage. And most businesses, they have nothing that they deliver on top of the generic. So they do not give any new value out there into the world. And that is where, I mean, I could go on and on about this, but effectively, you show me any business problem, I could track it back to this issue. Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
My first sort of proper paid weekly job was a holiday job as a student, which was driving a forklift truck at the Ribena factory.
Ah, Call to Action, episode 11, with the one and only Rory Sutherland. Not what we were looking for, but hang on a minute. Ah, there we go.
I really liked what you're saying about how that foundational that is, because not only from the kind of high angled view of business strategy, but everything down to, I suppose, the articulation of a strategy or of a brand positioning, for example, also needs to follow exactly what you've just said, because I'm sure we've both experienced a worrying amount of businesses that use the same bland words to describe themselves that everyone else does, whether it's their experts or whatever it might be, innovators. It just becomes meaningless, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, it's just like, let's just pull the thread on this a bit, because I just want to emphasize just how, it's obviously not easy, but just how one-dimensional and basic this really is, that like if you recognize that the only way that you're reliably going to make money, or at least in a very profitable, easy way without loads of hustle and sweat and fighting, is to put some form of value out there that people want, but that they can't get from anywhere else but you. That is fundamentally the thing that your business exists to produce. Nothing else. That is it. That's the entire story. That thing, whatever it is. Then you look at all the other parts of your business, and their only job is to deliver on that one thing, but in their own domain. So again, let's just break it very simply into like two parts: product and communications, let's say. So product, well, the product has to be designed in such a way as that it delivers the thing that you say that you're giving to people. So there has to be some kind of core innovation within what you do that makes that thing happen. So if we take like IKEA, classic example, like what is the value IKEA basically sort of pioneered and stand for? It's essentially you being able to have a designer interior at budget prices, right? So before them, you could either have sort of nice looking furniture or you could have cheap furniture, and they managed to kind of like fix that issue so that you didn't. How did they do that? I mean, there's lots of things. It's obviously more complicated than this, but their core innovation was obviously flat pack. Oh, if we make you build your own furniture, then we can give it to you a hell of a lot cheaper. And that kind of, that changes the nature of the furniture market. So product, it has this core innovation that actually delivers that thing. And then communication, branding, whatever you want to call it, that only has one job, which is to basically say to people, hey, this is the thing that we are selling you. And so you, and then you obviously want to do that in the most fetching and attention grabbing and creative a way possible. But fundamentally, you're just saying, hey, this is the thing, this is the form, this is the value we produce that you want to have. Here it is, buy it. And so then, again, if we look at IKEA, they obviously have this tagline, the wonderful every day, which is just a sexed up way of saying every day equals cheap, effectively, or accessible. Wonderful equals designer, pretty. So it's just another way of saying what their value offering is. You stick these things together, the product and the communication, and the value offering at the sort of top of the pyramid. That's a coherent business that, and no wonder it earns billions and billions of dollars, right? So it's just that simple. But of course, the reason it doesn't feel simple to businesses or to agencies for that matter is because most businesses do not have that thing at the top of that, at the top of the pyramid. They do not have a clear answer to the unique value that they're bringing to the market. And so when they're developing product, and when they're developing branding and comms, they actually don't know what the substance of those things should be because they don't actually have an idea that sits at the heart of the business. And that's why they then go to an agency and they almost say, I mean, what do they say to like branding agencies? They don't go to them and say, the thing that we are all about and that we want to communicate is X. Instead, they go to branding agencies and they say, tell us what we should communicate. And then the branding agency's got this hospital pass where basically this generic company has come along and said, hey, tell us what's not generic about us. And the branding agency is like, oh God, I don't know, probably nothing. But if we say it in with enough style, maybe we'll get away with it.
Yeah, totally. I think IKEA is a great example. And of course, IKEA is, as you say, product has led, I suppose, the positioning in so many ways, or the actual business itself, I suppose, if you don't need to compartmentalize it. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I have a feeling I'm maybe a decade or so older than you, Alex, so you may not have done, but there was a wonderful self-promotion piece that a very talented creative, whose name escapes me, but he's now part of BBC's creative team. I spoke to him last year about it. He did a parody ad for IKEA snowmen, and it was a mock-up of a sign in a very snowy field, and it just had a big IKEA logo, snowman self-assembly required. And it was so brilliant that the brand was so strong that it just carries the message so well.
Yeah, and I just want to pick up on something that you just said there, if I'm hearing you right, but because it is a sort of a kind of profound point, which is that you said like, oh, the product led the positioning.
Yeah.
this to me is where things become, why people find this so hard, because the highest level that they're thinking of in a kind of information hierarchy is product or brand or positioning. And they're sort of thinking which one leads the other, but they don't realize that there is one click higher. The level of business strategy is one click higher than brand. It's a click higher than product. It's a click higher than anything. It's simply the click to say, what does this business do? And most people aren't aware that this higher level exists because it's not like a thing, you know, like with, you know, that you have to have a product, common sense. You know that you have to have a brand insofar as people think, oh, well, I need to have a logo or however they interpret brand. But this idea that sits above them and unifies them, because it's not like a sort of item you can hold in your hand, people just don't even realize it exists. They don't even realize it's a job to do. And so people, they start their thinking process at that second tier level of like product or brand or whatever. And they do it, and they do a pretty bad job because they've never actually looked up and thought about the question of, right, what actually does this business do relative to the other options that are out there in the market? And once we've figured that out and we found essentially how it's going to win, what its point of leverage is, then we will think about brand and product and all the rest of it in order to deliver on that idea. Do you see what I mean? It's perhaps a slightly abstract point.
No, to be honest, it makes complete sense. We would talk about market orientation, certainly over, you know, anything that's product orientated, but you can understand, and you see businesses every day that are product orientated. And I think that's why there exists so much tension between different departments, similarly, you know, sales orientated business. How do you make strategy so simple that everyone in the organization not only understands it, but actually believes it? Because I think there is tension that exists within these departments if they don't have that guiding kind of principle or business strategy, whatever, however we want to describe it.
Well, the first step is that someone actually needs to take ownership of it. And that someone can only be the big boss, the chief exec, the founder, whoever. Because to my way of looking at it, that is effectively their only job. I mean, obviously you might have a more kind of like a more sort of shop steward kind of chief executive in a big corporation or whatever, but let's think about like founders. It's a little bit more simple that way. Like their only job is to basically think about what the business is and how the business is going to generate more value that is going to make the business grow. There are managerial elements to their job for sure, but like 70% of their time should be dedicated to this single task, because this task is the enabler, an accelerator of everything else that the business does. Now, of course, ironically, your average founder doesn't spend 70% of their time on this question. They spend 0% of their time on this question because they don't even know that it's a question. But if we just look at the archetypal legendary founders, your sort of Richard Branson, Steve Jobs type people, what we can see is that they were basically, fundamentally, the main thing they spent most of their time doing was propagandizing on behalf of their strategy. They had a very clear idea, like a creative idea of what the business was for. And they basically then just went around hammering people over the head with it day in, day out until that sort of like got into their skulls. I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard a story of some chief exec who would go around the office with $5 bills in his pocket, and he would ask people on the spot words to the effect of what is our strategy or however he articulated it. If they could answer, he would give them $5. And if they couldn't, then he wouldn't. And I think that's a really brilliant idea, because you need to have this one single idea be the thing that is most top of mind for everybody in the organization. So first thing, someone actually has to take that responsibility. Then you come onto the question of how they do that. I mean, we can get into this in more detail if you want, but the short answer is you obviously need to be very, very good at narrativizing the strategy. So it's one thing to say, like, the way this business is going to make money is by delivering such and such a thing to the customers, which they can't get from this brand and this brand, you know, a sort of like a kind of cold strategic write-up. But the more that you can kind of turn that into a kind of crusading, heroic narrative that people can buy into, again, something which someone like Steve Jobs was obviously absolute master at, the more it's going to stick in people's brains and the more that they are going to feel like they are part of this story and that they want to push it forward. I mean, there's, on the subject of IKEA, I don't know if you've ever read it, but there's this handbook that the IKEA founder wrote back in the 70s, Testament of a Furniture Dealer, which is basically his piece of propaganda. And they make every single new IKEA employee read it. And it's quite long. You know, it's like, I don't know, 40 pages or something. It's a decent chunky thing. Again, it's the same equivalent of this. If you look at any of these great founders, they all have this core myth of the business that they sort of insist upon to people. And the strategy of the business will be baked into that myth. And the genius of it is that the myth doesn't seem like a cold piece of business strategy. The myth seems like this super exciting call to arms, but it's been built around a core, highly commercial strategic nugget. So, you know, spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. So I think that these are the main things, assuming, of course, that you actually do have that core idea in the first place.
Yeah, totally. I do agree. I think, as I said to you before we started recording, because we agree on so much, I might have to play protagonist at some point. One of the comments that I would have against that, and this is in full agreement, is that the reality sometimes looks quite different in terms of the makeup of a business. So the likes of Steve Jobs and other names you've mentioned tend to be the outliers, and it's no accident that they're, you know, hugely successful both commercially and from a, you know, from a true proper marketing perspective. The issue I see in 16 years of running our agency is that very few CMOs become CEOs, and actually it's more common for a CEO to come from, say, a product background, or even more likely a sales background. And so actually getting buy-in at that level is so critical, but actually tends to be where the marketers find there is a huge amount of friction, which often means the topic of brand, for example, isn't one that's regularly discussed around the boardroom table. Have you experienced that? And do you have any tips in on that specifically?
Well, I think there's one bit of context that's important to note here, which is to say that strategy is optional. It's not required.
Yeah.
Never forget the failed businesses. Most successful businesses are trotting along quite happily without any strategy. What they're doing is they are, at some point in the past, they'll have succeeded probably more by luck than judgment, or because of the contacts, or because they have good funding, or whatever it might be. And then they basically just sort of like hustle their way through the market in a sort of incremental, experimental fashion, trying to, you know, improve their sales techniques, hiring agencies to do sexy marketing to sort of create an impression of differentiation when no differentiation exists, and doing all the stuff that most people think is just the day-to-day realities of doing business. Most of the day-to-day realities of doing business are actually compensations for the absence of strategy. In a truly quote-unquote strategic organization, things look quite different. So we need to recognize that there are actually very few organizations out there that are like this. So in a way, that means that someone like Steve Jobs is actually not an outlier. He's actually sort of extreme version of the archetype. But the reason he appears to be an outlier is just because he's doing something that most other founders just don't do at all. So it's not like he's doing it so much better than them. He's just playing a game that they're opting out of. I think that's an important thing to note. And so when we look at most other businesses, like just because they're not doing this, and just because we can say, well, look, there's no Steve Jobs in charge of, I don't know, Haribo, or just like some sort of big successful other brand, that is because it's perfectly possible, particularly with these older, more legacy businesses that cropped up in a different era. It's very, very possible to live without this. This then, I think, is why you get these sort of managerial chief executives coming through, because, and again, this is particularly true in legacy businesses that, like, I mean, look, you, I mean, just to, not to pick on Haribo, I don't know why that's the one that came into my mind. Like, within reason, you couldn't drive Haribo into the ground if you wanted to. It's just there. And the decisions made by management in that company don't really have a very meaningful impact on what happens to the business. Haribo is not going to go bust next year, and Haribo is also not going to 10x next year either. It's just going to chug along. Now, in this context, you could actually go so far as to make a point that you do not want someone to come in and make any high-risk moves and rock the boat or do anything, frankly, remotely interesting, because sort of what is the point? There's this guy called Michael Rayner, and he came up with this thing called the strategy paradox, which is very true and very interesting, where he said, strategy does not make you less likely to fail. It actually makes you more likely to fail, because by definition, it means that you are going to make a move and you're going to try something. He said the opposite of, I'm not quoting this quite right, but you'll get my point. So the opposite of strategy is not failure, it's mediocrity. So it's very logical to choose to run a business in a mediocre way. This is a legitimate alternative to strategy, which it would be really foolish to sniff at. Not everybody wants to kind of go for broke, make a big move, and maybe become revered like Steve Jobs or go bust. This is a particular game, which you're well within your rights not to play. So in these organizations and where the marketer might want to go through with something, let's say, more ambitious, I'm going to go out on a limb with no statistics to back this up, and you'll know better than me. So maybe you can tell me if you think this is broadly true in your experience. But like, marketers and people of that persuasion are given short shrift in well-established businesses that aren't going to go bust and aren't going to 10x. But in businesses who are choosing between bust or 10x, the dynamic's very different and their contribution is going to be much more valued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. The point I was going to add was that I have unfairly, I fully admit, talked about marketing in small businesses versus large multinational businesses as being doing marketing in difficult mode, and working in massive established entities is marketing in easy mode. And there are, without meaning to offend a significant portion of our listeners, There is a truth there, which I think Mimi Turner from the LinkedIn B2B Institute, when she came on the show a few months ago, she actually articulated it slightly better. And she said, which is very much aligned to the points you've just been making, is that these big established businesses often win by accident rather than in easy mode. And there's huge benefits for being that size, and we could probably dig into all sorts of academic research and science from the likes of Ehrenberg Bass that would reinforce the point. I don't think we need to for the points of this conversation, but there isn't a level playing field. And so, yeah, I think your comment there without the statistics is likely true.
Yeah, it used to be quite a big, I don't think it is an issue anymore, but there was an issue for a long time where young businesses would look up to brands like Nike and Coke and all that kind of thing, and they would try and learn lessons from them.
Yeah.
And it was suicidal because the rules couldn't be more different. And also those businesses, they got their foothold in the market at a time where essentially the constraint was supply, whereas now the constraint is demand, as in like you need to be, anyone can make anything. The hard part is generating demand for it. Whereas back in those days, if you could make it, people would buy it because whatever it was just didn't exist. And so you cannot learn things as a new brand from these old brands because they were and still are playing a totally different game. So you would get so many errors made because of using these guys as role models. These days, I don't think that happens anymore. I don't think that young founders, look up to Coke now, for sake of argument. I think that's probably not a thing anymore.
Yeah, there's definitely some truth there. I think you can admire Coca-Cola for kind of historic decisions and work they've done, like making their bottle so iconic. To coin and to badly quote the original brief they had, they wanted the glass bottle to be identifiable, even if it was felt in the dark or smashed on the ground. So in terms of like creating distinctive assets, I think it's wonderful. But yeah, I completely agree with you. I once saw a really funny, quite witty retort by someone on Twitter before it became, the bin fire that it is today, where someone, I think a frustrated founder, commented something quite harmlessly like, oh, I wish my business had a logo like Nike, because then it would be so much easier, or something like a little bit ignorant. And this guy or person replied, yeah, all you need is a simple icon and about £100 billion worth of advertising over the last few decades. Because I think it's so easy to miss that fact that you know, you're not going to learn from someone with that much firepower unless you have amounts.
100%, yeah.
So yeah, it's brilliant. How have you, before we get on to listener questions, I'm mindful I'm keeping you longer than I said I would, Alex. Apologies.
It's all good, it's all good.
But just quickly, how have you applied everything we've just talked about and your own kind of strategic smarts to growing your own business and like what you do personally on LinkedIn, for example? Has that taught you anything? Have you kind of learned by doing that as well?
So much. And yeah, so much so that I'm just like groping for what would be a succinct way of answering this question. It occurred to me, like, now I have these sort of products, right? So as opposed to selling my time consulting, which I still do, but I also have my book, which is obviously a product, and I have this sort of thing, the strategy shortcut system, this sort of DIY strategy program thing.
Yeah. And the hidden path we should also mention.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, the newsletter, yeah, but obviously it's not paid. So it occurred to me that, like, before I had these things, you know, for a long time, I guess I was sort of touting myself directly or indirectly as a business expert. A business expert who had never sold a single thing in his life. Selling your time does not count, right? When I say selling something, it has to be something that is not you. And this could be like selling lemonade from a lemonade stand. And I tell you, the first time that I managed to get money in exchange for an item, everything changed and I realized how ignorant I was. And it sort of put me into the same kind of headspace as obviously my clients had always been. And I recognized that the game is completely different than what you understand theoretically as an expert. And obviously this is going to cut quite hard against a lot of people in agency land listening to this, but you know, I am one of you. And so I'm empathizing with this, but you don't see it until you get on the other side, that if you actually want to be an expert and to be able to give sort of truly useful advice, you've got to go and sell something. And I don't care what it is. You could go and sell brooms or encyclopedias. You just have to get that experience of actually selling something, because then everything changes. Because what it does is it detaches you from your business, and it detaches you from the thing that you're selling in a way that, you know, if you're selling your time, you don't. So we can think about these as this sort of mindset as being sort of freelancer mindset. I mean, you've obviously got employee mindset. So if you're an employee, we all know how that works. Then freelancer is just like an employee, but without the structure of a company around you. But it's actually the same thing as being an employee. You're just going to find the contracts to work for. And then let's say you've got entrepreneur mindset. Now, there are a lot of people out there, myself included for a long time, who they think that they're entrepreneurs. They think that they're running a business, but they're actually just freelancers. You know, they're kind of kidding themselves because they haven't managed to create this detachment with their business. And it was when I started to detach and start to sell products that were separate from myself, that is when I was able to start applying strategy to what I was doing. Because when you're doing that, you stop thinking about what you're doing in terms of the individual customers and sort of doing a good job for the customer, which is the way that a freelancer thinks. You know, it's the way a personal trainer thinks. It's the way a designer thinks. It's the way a cleaner thinks or whatever. So that's all the kind of like freelance mindset. And you start thinking in terms of, what am I doing for the industry? So this is the big dividing line that I had to go over and that I'm still crossing over. And I think that everyone has to cross over, where you start thinking like, my goal here is to change the dynamics of this industry. My goal is not just to serve customers as well as I can. And when you do that, it's basically an act of sort of raising your gaze up from the level of the individual customer. And then you look across the whole of your category and the whole of your industry and you think, right, what's wrong here? And how can I change this? So the example that I always think of here is like, Starbucks was not founded by a barista. And the founder of Starbucks was not obsessive about making the best coffee in the world. In fact, he didn't care whether the coffee was good or bad. He wanted the coffee to be whatever was necessary for him to make a big play in the global cafe market. So it's the same thing with me, where you have to like take this mindset shift from like, okay, where am I focusing? Am I focusing on doing a good job for my clients and becoming the best strategist I can possibly be? And trying to like, you know, give them a great service and then move on to the next client? Or am I actually interested in how I can change the strategy industry writ large? Even if that means actually my individual clients suffer for it in some way. Either because I deliberately make my product in some way inferior, in the same way as that we could argue that Starbucks's coffee is inferior to some speciality, one branch, passion project coffee shop, or because I just spend a lot more of my time thinking about the big picture than I spend thinking about delivering. I'm sure that you've heard people say any business should spend 70-80% of its time on marketing and innovation and only like 10% on admin, 10% on delivery. Most businesses don't operate that way. Most businesses spend 80% of their time on delivery, and then they think things like marketing, admin, and God forbid, innovation are kind of side projects, bolt-ons to the core job of delivery. This is completely backwards. This is completely backwards, which again, this is all part of that progress from freelancer mindset to entrepreneur mindset. You are, I'm being painting in very broad brushstrokes here, but you know, you're an entrepreneur when you spend 70-80% of your time looking big picture and doing marketing and innovation and just kind of farming out the delivery of whatever your product is. You're a freelancer, even if you're in charge of like, you know, a £50 million agency, you're still fundamentally a pimped freelancer if you're spending 80% of your time hustling on delivery and marketing and innovation are an afterthought. Sorry, it was a bit of a garbled answer. Like I told you, I just got too much to say on this particular
That's all good.
But just to loop it back to your original point, like this is the change, the sort of like the mindset change I've had to go through in order to start swallowing my own medicine. And to be perfectly honest with you, before I did this, there's a very real sense that all of the advice I gave before this was compromised because I didn't get this thing that I've been describing to you.
Well, do you know what? I think it's really encouraging. I think that people recognize that they're learning. Like to say the advice was compromised is a nice way of putting it, albeit maybe slightly unfair to yourself and quite extreme. But
I'm not saying it was definitely wrong, no, but it was just like, yeah. I would like to review it now.
Yeah. Totally. But you know what? I think that's a realistic and healthy position for almost everyone to be in because it shows that we're kind of developing. I think when people stagnate, Absolutely, that's probably more of a concern. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to go to listener questions now, Alex. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. But we have asked, and I'm going to try and squeeze two in if there's time. So question one is from Roger Mendoza, which came in on LinkedIn, so you might have seen it already. Roger says, Alex's approach is refreshing. It's about time we swap conventionality for authenticity in strategy. What innovative approaches are you seeing?
So I don't know if this is about innovative approaches in strategy or with regards to authenticity in general, but I don't really see anything in strategy because I don't pay any attention to it, which has always been the way. And I don't think that's a good thing, but I feel like in some sense the naivety gives me my edge. So I don't want to know too much.
Nice.
But more broadly, I think that this trend to authenticity, if you can call it that, I mean, this is going to gradually hit every single industry on the planet. I think other people have made this point more articulately, but we're moving to a point where the most powerful voice in each given industry ceases to be a brand or a company and it becomes a person. And just industries are moving at different speeds to get there. Some industries got there a long time ago. Other industries are still a long way away from it. And I just got lucky with strategy in that it's a very staid and corporate kind of field. So it hadn't yet been sort of social media-ified the way that I'm currently doing it, not as far as I'm aware anyway. And we're just going to see that happening everywhere. I've got a buddy who's a plastic surgeon in North Virginia. And so this is medicine. And okay, it's the kind of the optional sort of consumer good end of the medicine spectrum compared to other things, but he's doing all just the same. So, you know, we're going to see medicine get this more human, authentic face over time. We're going to see it happen to sort of financial services. We're going to see it happen to everything. So I just think that I'm just one of the early movers of this trend in this particular industry. And I'm sure that we'll see way more.
Yeah, cool. Good answer. Question two comes from Sarah. Sarah asks, there are 5.5 million SMEs, so small to medium enterprises in the UK, many operating without a proper strategy. What single strategic superpower would you upload to the brains of the people running the businesses?
Oh man, yeah, to boil it down into a sort of a single power, I think I would actually go back to, I'd do a call back to the answer that I gave before, which is to say, stop thinking about your customer, start thinking about your industry. Make that be the focus of your kind of creative attentions, and then everything flows from there. So it's a question of just sort of raising your gaze and to think more contextually about your business. This obviously doesn't mean that you do a horrible job for your customers, but true answers and opportunities are going to be found by looking out into the world around you. They're not going to be found in the relationship that you have with an individual customer on the day-to-day level.
Yeah, cool. Good answer. Good question, Sarah. The final part of the interview then, Alex, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Starting with number one, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh man, I had to do a social media post on this recently, so surely I can pluck something from that, because I'm going to be 40 next month. So, you know, time to reflect.
Okay.
I think I would go for the job description, and you can read job description as broadly as you want. The job description is a starting point, not the target. So even if we just think about that in the context of a quite literal job description and not more broadly, people think that they're going to get promoted by hitting the bullet points on the job description. But if you do that, actually, all you're doing is you're just showing that you're in exactly the place you should be. And why should you ever raise higher, be promoted, grow to something better? It's the stuff that you do that isn't on the job description that defines who you are, how you give value, and what's actually going to push you forward. You know, and that could be a job description for a relationship or the job description for a company writ large, anything. The rule always applies.
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah, that's a great answer. Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
I can't say that I think there's anything, because all of the things that I don't like just act as counterpositions to me. So okay, if they went away, then I'd lose my leverage.
Screwed.
Everything needs to roll on exactly as it is. That's my desire.
Nice, 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 nice. That's a good answer. I don't think we've had that before as well, actually, which is always refreshing. Number three, are there any books that you would recommend to our listeners? Aside from No Bullshit Strategy, obviously, which we have linked to in this listing.
Yeah, the ones that spring to mind are, if you want a sort of like another strategy book, and I've read almost no strategy books, so I'm not good at this, but the one that I like the best is 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. I mean, that's maybe because it's just the one that's most similar to mine in that it's very short, but that was quite influential for me. Then more broadly, all of Nassim Taleb's books, The Incerto, they contributed a lot as well. And Walter Isaacson's books about Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, regardless of what you think of them, if you need to see the sort of the psychological portrait of the people who are kind of thinking in a strategic way, again, you don't have to take that as an endorsement. It's just a fact. And those, Walter Isaacson, he just does an incredible job of that in both of those books. So those were both extremely useful to me. And then the final, if you fancy I know that there are some sort of strategists listening to this and they like to read dense academic things. And there's this book called The Matter with Things by Ian McGilchrist, which nominally is about the difference between the left brain and right brain perceptions of the world. But it's actually about, if this isn't too grandiose, the sort of nature of reality itself. And you can trace a lot of that back to everything that we've been talking about here. I'll sort of leave it at that, but be warned, it's a 2,000-page book. So, you know, you're either into that or you're not.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds quite heavy. Do you read outside of the kind of industry books? Like, do you read fiction at all, or are you a complete weirdo like me who doesn't?
No, I don't read inside the industry, to be honest. It's the opposite. Yeah, no, I mean, fiction, non-fiction, 50-50, very little business, because I'm just too afraid. Every time I read a business book, they say something that I've thought before, but that I thought I was the only one. And I don't take that in a positive, like, validating way. I take that in a, oh, shit, like, that was mine. And actually, it isn't. So, yeah, so I just avoid it.
We had a guest before who had a similar approach to reading, as in they didn't, and actually ended up recommending a couple of Netflix shows, which were well received. So, yeah, I'm entirely media neutral on answers to that.
That's good, yeah.
And then the last one, Alex, is we always ask our guests to dedicate the episode to someone with a little reason why. Is there anyone you could kindly dedicate this episode to?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that is definitely a question I've never been asked. Well, I think since I've been pushing harder in the way that I was describing, in that entrepreneurial way, I'm doing this at the same time as having a one-year-old and a four-year-old. So you can imagine or even know what that's like. So I would have to dedicate it, of course, to my wife, who, you know, the slack that she picks up and the foundation that she provides for all of this. I mean, that's obviously the engine underneath everything. And that's why I can be faffing about on podcasts and doing all this other kind of stuff without worrying about keeping everything else afloat. And there is a lot of other stuff to keep afloat in my life at the moment. So yes, to Caroline for that.
Amazing. Well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to Caroline. Amazing. We had an earlier cameo from, well, either a 1 or a 4-year-old. It was hard for me.
It was a one-year-old.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, my
Caroline
team and
really
nine...
dropped the ball on that one, didn't she?
Yeah. Do we retract? Amazing. I have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, so I've kind of been there, albeit I'm a few laps ahead, but it's a lovely dedication, and I know how much truth there is to how you articulated it. So that's brilliant. So listen, as a final call to action, we will link, everyone listening can find links to Alex's book, No Bullshit Strategy, the strategy shortcut system, which Alex touched on lightly, Alex's newsletter, The Hidden Path. You have a huge presence on LinkedIn, obviously, but where else can our listeners get more Alex Smith?
I mean, the best one is definitely the newsletter, but now I'm trying to make it work on Instagram, which is a sort of a real learning curve. So bear with me on that. But yes, any support, much appreciated there. And that's Alex M.H. Smith on there. And I'm about to start, as I was talking about with the studio set up here, YouTube is the next thing in line, which I'm looking forward to, because I think that's going to be very famous last words. I think it's going to be a very natural platform for this stuff. So yes, nice. Give that a couple of weeks and then off we go.
Fantastic. Amazing. Well, Alex, listen, thank you for joining us. It's been loads of fun. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, me too. It's been great. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email the mouthful, that is a call to action, at gasp.agency.
Try, and I try, and I try.